This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, in for Jane Lindholm. Vermonters have a rather long history of sliding around on the snow. Lore has it that Norwegians around Stowe were skiing in the early 1900s. Back in the mid-30s, a ski tow appeared on a mountain in Woodstock. There was Perry Merrill, who was called the man who put Vermont on skis. And then there's Jake Burton, who maybe didn't invent snowboarding, but he made sure that it became rather popular. For some skiers and riders, taking a chairlift up a resort mountain and carving down well-groomed hills is the way to enjoy the snow. And then there's those who forsake the warm lodge and the fast gondola ride. Those are the adventurous souls who love to head into the backcountry on purpose. Backcountry skiing and riding is what we're going to focus on today, and here to enlighten us on how the sport is faring in Vermont are Brian Moore. He's the volunteer coordinator of the Vermont Backcountry Alliance, and Michael Snyder, Vermont's Commissioner of Forest Parks and Recreation. Great to have you both with us today.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Rick.
So, Brian, we're going to start with you, and I want you to define backcountry sports for those who might not be familiar.
Well, I think it means a lot of different things depending on your approach to getting out on skis or snowboards or using a sled. It could mean going out the back door, heading out across your neighbor's pastures and skiing a sloped hillside out in the open, or taking to the higher terrain and higher mountainsides on our state and federal lands up and down the Green Mountain.
Now, a few terms that might come up today are backcountry, ski touring, and telemark. And very briefly, can you differentiate between those?
I think backcountry skiing and riding generally means climbing uphill to and earning your own turns. And you can do that on a variety of different types of equipment. Telemark equipment, alpine touring gear in the skiing realm, split boards that snowboarders are using, snowboards that actually split into two skis for the ascent, and then attach back into one snowboard for the descent. So there's a lot of different kinds of equipment people use.
And what is it that you find so alluring of backcountry?
I think it's the freedom, the mobility of moving around in the mountains on your own, at your own pace, in fresh snow, in solitude, if that's what we're after one day, or with friends and enjoying it on our own terms in our own environment, exploring this beautiful state.
And Brian Moore, I introduced to you as the volunteer coordinator for the Vermont Backcountry Alliance. This is a brand new organization. So first of all, why don't you tell us what the purpose is of that alliance?
Well, the Vermont Backcountry Alliance came to life last fall, really, thanks to the incredible energy of the Rochester Area Sports Trails Alliance, which is a new group down in the Rochester, Vermont area in the heart of the Green Mountains. They hosted a forum around backcountry skiing last November, and that really was the spark that lit the fire under this new Vermont Backcountry Alliance. And over the last year, conversations with the Catamount Trail Association, a longstanding organization in Vermont that's been dedicated to establishing the 300-mile-long Catamount Trail, which is one of the longest backcountry ski trails in the country, those conversations led to a really strong partnership with the Catamount Trail Association. And now the Vermont Backcountry Alliance is officially a program of the Catamount Trail Association.
So why was it necessary to form this organization, this alliance?
I think with a lot of communities, it's a natural step to get organized. And over the years, Vermont's backcountry skiing and riding community has come a long ways. And in recent years, with the explosion of the popularity of backcountry skiing and riding, folks are talking more and more about developing backcountry projects and programs in their local communities. So with respect to the state and the National Forest Service and conversations that some of these local groups like the Rochester Area Sports Trails Alliance have been having, we thought it made sense to get a larger statewide organization in place.
They have a great name, Rasta.
Yes.
We're discussing backcountry skiing and riding today. Want to know if you look forward to adding new areas for backcountry sports, or are you against their expansion? And what role do you think the state needs to take in this movement? You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Now, Michael Snyder, you are the Commissioner of Forest Parks and Recreation. So what interest does your department have in these backcountry sports?
Well, we have significant interest. It's the Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation, and so this is the recreation part. And so we have a longstanding tradition and a mission that includes promoting appropriate, healthy outdoor recreation. And as Brian has been indicating, there's terrific growing interest in backcountry pursuits, and we want to help get that right. So we want to make public lands, our state lands, available for these uses, balanced with other uses. And we want to help promote these kind of pursuits on private lands as well. And we feel that's an appropriate role for us to be convener and facilitator to try to help in what, as Brian has indicated, is that we need to be organized. And it's we're thrilled with the development of this Backcountry Alliance and the partnerships that are forming. We're playing our role in that, and we're really proud of that, and getting organized and including developing a set of ethics for how to treat backcountry use, how to make better access available on state lands, really just kind of keeping it all together and promoting and accepting this burgeoning use, but doing it well.
Does your department have a regulatory role in this?
I wouldn't call it that. I mean, we have a stewardship role, and we have a responsibility to steward the state's a few hundred thousand acres of state lands. And part of our mission, as I said, is to allow use of those lands, mm-hmm. For all Vermonters, including recreational use. So that's where how we enter into this.
And then how are you going to be working with the Alliance, and what do you hope that they'll accomplish?
Well, we want to see them form and mature and become like other statewide partners that we have in the recreation realm, be it the Vermont Association of Snow Travelers for snowmobiling, the Green Mountain Club for hiking. We have these relationships with such organizations around the state that help us partner to do it right on state lands and to be organized and successful on private lands as well. And that's what we're trying to build here, is that same kind of stable, long-term relationship where we partner to help. And our interest really at this point is to make sure we provide legitimate access on state lands while balancing it with all the other uses and needs of those state lands.
Mm-hmm. We did get this from Grant, who posted on our page. It would be great to see some straightforward, high-quality backcountry skiing options come to life for average skiers and snowboarders, even backcountry sledders around the state. The few nice areas that exist now are centered around Stowe and Bolton and are plenty busy. Creating options so people don't have to drive far either would be a major plus. It seems there's plenty of backcountry terrain everywhere in Vermont, so it's only a matter of getting organized around managing some areas here and there. I hope this is what is taking shape. Brian Moore, is this the goal, and is this what you're working towards with the Vermont Backcountry Alliance?
I think that's definitely a big part of it. You know, there's more and more interest than ever, among local communities in developing places to ski locally, be it our neighbors, you know, a farming neighbor's hillside, be it an abandoned ski area like Dutch Hill or Hogback Mountain in southern Vermont, or be it the locations that Rasta has been focused on up in the Green Mountain National Forest or on a piece of conserved land in Braintree, Vermont that they've been developing and are planning to be responsibly managing moving forward. So I think it's definitely about terrain, creating more terrain for groups that are interested in pursuing those channels. But it's about a lot of other things too. I think what one common drive among many of us is the idea of the potential for the backcountry skiing and riding community to be advancing mountain lands conservation around the state, so that we all have vast areas of mountain country to enjoy and to get out and ski and explore without any managed terrain necessarily. And having that larger landscape intact, long-term, conserved, will ensure that more wild type of skiing and riding experience. Education and safety, encouraging partnering with organizations and ski areas and retailers and others to advance backcountry safety and education. That's definitely an important piece of it. And building partnerships throughout the community to support communities that want to develop backcountry projects and programs, whatever they may be. There's a lot of interest in developing backcountry huts in Vermont, mm-hmm. for skiing and riding in the wintertime, and maybe that would double function as mountain bike huts in the summertime. So a lot of exciting ideas starting to hit the map.
And Michael Snyder, has the state been working to identify areas that might be developed for more backcountry opportunities?
Yes. And it's actually kind of fun to do that. I mean, we know that there's already ongoing use out there. Some of it includes unauthorized cutting and development. We're really significantly concerned about that. That's a real concern because we just, as I've said earlier, we just want to get it right. And so instead, we're saying, hey, we basically went to these forums and put out our recreation coordinator, Jessica Savage, provided this form to say, here's some maps. Where do you want to be? That doesn't mean you're going to be anywhere and everywhere, but we want to know where are the opportunities, where's the interest. We want to listen to what the needs are, and then we're going to try to fit that into our plans with all the other needs for these lands, including habitat protection, biodiversity, healthy forests, forest management, and other forms of recreation. So we're hoping to be able to build a system of access for that spans the spectrum. And I really like the caller, the request about various terrains, and I think that's part we Brian and I were talking earlier, we have exceptional, challenging terrain. I think it's important to also make it accessible for novice skiers and to grow this. We see so many benefits for getting people outdoors on the land, economic development locally, health benefits, and environmental awareness. All of those things accrue from this, and that's why we're eager to respond to the need and do it in an organized fashion that provides a range of access and possibilities.
And does the state prefer that this occur on state lands, or does it matter?
We want to do our part. We think I think we have some exceptional skiing and riding possibilities on state lands, and we know that. But we're not the only game in town, so we want to do our part to provide a legitimate opportunity. But as we've said, we also think it's important to help foster that same approach on private lands. We should say, I think Brian mentioned, the Green Mountain National Forest is also a partner here, and that's federal lands, and I think that's wonderful to have the whole mix.
We're talking about the growing numbers of Vermonters who are seeking time and adventure in the backcountry and the role of the state, and a new volunteer group that wants to create some harmony around backcountry sports. Are you a backcountry skier or rider? What do you enjoy about the sport, and what do you think needs to be done to improve it in Vermont? You can call 1-800-639-2211, or you can post on the Vermont Edition page. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Some skiers and riders look for an adventure more challenging than taking a chairlift and sliding down groomed runs, and those folks go into the backcountry. But with limited opportunities and more participants, backcountry trails are seeing heavier use. A new organization has been created to try to address this and other issues. It's the Vermont Backcountry Alliance. We're speaking with the volunteer coordinator for the alliance, Brian Moore, and also joining us is Vermont's Forest, Parks, and Recreation Commissioner, Michael Snyder. And listeners, you can join the discussion on backcountry skiing and riding. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your comments or questions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Brian Moore, as you try to expand terrain projects in the state, are you getting pushback from those in the backcountry community?
I think there's a lot of concern that any new terrain development has got to be done right. And so what we're doing there in 2015 is working with a variety of partners, including the state, the conservation community, the Green Mountain National Forest, to develop a backcountry terrain management handbook, for lack of a sexier term. And that handbook is going to be a great resource moving forward for local communities that want to develop projects in their local communities. And it's very similar to what the International Mountain Biking Association did with their Trail Solutions Handbook some years ago. And that remains an incredible resource for local communities. So we're really just at the beginning here. And this is a bottom-up effort. And we're relying on local groups to come to us and say, we'd like some help doing something close to home.
Michael Snyder, as these new opportunities are being created, are there things that you want to make sure are done, aren't done as they're developed?
Of course. I mean, we have a great responsibility here. And so there's a lot of possibilities and opportunity, and we're thrilled about that. And we as I said earlier, we want to get it right. And those, what it comes down to is really two things. We want to make sure, we want to help instill an ethic of responsible use that considers all the values that are on the land. And then the next piece is, how do you do it and not love it to death? And how do you not, we know that skiing in the woods often includes some modification to what's the vegetation that's out there.
Right.
So glades are popular, and opening a ski line to be more skiable. Personally, I'm a forester professionally. I'm also a backcountry skier. So I have a keen interest in the second piece, which is responsible, sustainable glade and backcountry trail development, so that we keep it going, so that they're because death by a thousand cuts is a real possibility. And we know that it, from past experience, that glades that are developed in the woods often, if they run a real serious risk of just becoming open trails. And that's – nobody wants that.
Well, that is definitely one area of contention. As a matter of fact, a few years ago we had a serious issue up in the Northeast Kingdom. A couple guys decided they would clear out an area and were a little bit more overzealous. Have we been seeing a lot of that, and how does your department police that kind of thing?
So that was a well-known, a seriously unfortunate experience in Jay. That's been dealt with. I think it's been used as an example, and I think people are aware we need to avoid that. That's not – there's no future there. I'm happy to say we don't think that's been happening. On occasion, we do get some calls and complaints of people saying, I suspect people are doing some illegal cutting. We're aware of it. Heck, I've seen it myself as a skier. But nothing to that extent. And I think that's actually helped, that people realize. And as Brian has said, bottom up, the skiers and riders who want to do this are starting to understand that we need to self-police, we need to do this together and keep that kind of thing from happening. And I think so far, so good.
We have another area of contention that Dave in Fairfax emailed us about, and he says, I'd like to see some help from the state in establishing ground rules for skinning at ski resorts on state land. Many folks skin uphill in the morning or evening because of work obligations. There does not seem to be a consistent policy from resort to resort on this. It seems to me there should be a consistent policy for all ski resorts utilizing state land to allow taxpayers to access state property. If it's safe for some resorts to do so, why is it not the same for all? Michael Snyder, how do you respond to that?
Well, it's a great point. We're aware of it. It's an area of real interest for me. So we have seven ski areas, commercial ski areas in the state that lease land from our department. That's a great tradition, I believe, going back to Perry Merrill that you mentioned earlier, one of my predecessors. And we work with those skiers. They have this a lease agreement to use those lands for their commercial ski operations. And they have legitimate interests in safety and their operations and need to be concerned about uphill traffic. We, myself and our staff, have worked with the leadership of all seven ski areas to make a request to find a way to accommodate this need, this desire for folks who want to skin up early or late and earn their turns and enjoy that. It needs to be pointed out, people often say, well, that's state land. We should be able to do it.
Right.
It's true, and it's a fair question, but the serious response is that, yes, but these folks have a legal right to control access, that they've earned it. Those are the terms of the lease. These are long-term leases. And I'm happy to say that we're seeing some movement there. I know Killington is a real shining example of finding a way to designate an uphill route that can be navigated safely, that their groomers and snowmaking staff don't have to worry about it, and people are safe. And I think that's a good trend. And I'm going to continue to push to find a rational way through so that we can provide both safe operations of the ski areas and opportunities for people to skin up and ski down.
And Brian Moore, we're using that term skinning. You probably should explain to people what that is.
Well, skinning generally involves attaching a pair of fabric to the base of your ski or snowboard. And that fabric is smooth in one direction and has hairs that grab in the other direction, much like the fur of a seal. So you attach those to the bottom of your skis or boards, and you climb the mountain with that traction. And then when you get to the top, you peel off your skins, you fold them up, stick them in your pack, tighten up your boots, flip down your goggles, and off you go.
And does the Alliance have a stand as to your members using ski resorts to skin up a mountain?
I think a lot of folks who are interested in supporting the Vermont Backcountry Alliance also patronize our ski areas, and myself included. I love riding lifts and getting that incredible amount of vertical that you can gain from riding lifts and then descending. So ski areas are definitely a part of the larger backcountry picture in Vermont. And we're interested, we're engaged already with the ski areas in encouraging them to promote more uphill skiing accommodation. And that's an ongoing conversation.
And as far as those who do use the resort to skin up, is there an issue with time of day? Is it better to go at a specific time of day, worse to go at others?
I think with each ski area, you know, there's different issues. Some ski areas have more direct routes to the upper elevations. Others, it creates situations where the uphill traffic is conflicting with the downhill traffic. But the reality is that the ski areas are really interested in this issue, and they're trying to be more accommodating. Nationwide, we've seen a 25% increase in ski areas establishing uphill skiing policies just in the last year. So that's really encouraging. And like I said, you know, ski areas are, you know, located throughout the state in the heart of backcountry terrain as well. So not too far from a ski area is often some really ideal backcountry skiing terrain. So the more we can work with the ski areas to come up with programs that work best for that larger, broader skiing and riding community, I think the more success we'll have. And just to mention, our folks who support and are interested in pitching into the Vermont Backcountry Alliance, our parent organization is the Catamount Trail Association. So if you support the Vermont Backcountry Alliance, we're encouraging folks to join or consider becoming members of the Catamount Trail Association, our parent organization.
Michael Snyder, another area of concern for people is when we have people going off trail, unprepared, getting lost. Is the root of that problem overconfident skiers? What's going on there? Why we've had quite a number of episodes of this over the last few years.
Indeed. And we need to be aware of that. And I think all involved here have that on the list. Emergency rescue. So those folks have been involved in these conversations. And we need to make sure folks are prepared and know where they're and how to be prepared and how to think about what's needed so that your enthusiasm for what lies out there doesn't get the best of you because it's dangerous for one and it becomes expensive and troublesome for everybody. I'm really happy to say that the Backcountry Alliance, Catamount Trail Association, our folks, they've all been engaged with you know, the various backcountry rescue crews around the state to be organized in this way, and I think we're going to get it right.
Yeah, we're making some real progress there. This month, actually, we're going to be finalizing a set of Vermont backcountry ethics in partnership with Leave No Trace, which is a national level organization, and it's really going to be a set of common sense guidelines to think about when you head out into the backcountry. And we're hoping the ski areas, retailers, Nordic centers can post these Vermont backcountry ethics. We can put them up at trailheads, friendly reminders to folks who might not be as experienced, and it might help tip the scales in the direction of safer travel and fewer rescues.
What are a couple tips you'd like people to know of right now?
Well, Leave No Trace relies on seven real standard guidelines. Plan ahead and prepare. Travel on durable surfaces, meaning when the snow's getting thin, stick to the snow. Don't trample the vegetation. Dispose of your waste properly. Leave things as they are. Minimize campfire and hut impacts. Respect wildlife. And be considerate of others. So,
we got this from Peter, who writes, "For me, the biggest success of the movement will be when backcountry skiing is recognized as a legitimate activity like hunting and fishing. It's okay to see a truck parked along the road and someone heading into the woods to spend the day alone hunting or fishing. Right now, the backcountry skiers who do this are seen as weird or worse as reckless risk takers." Very difficult a clause to say. But how do you educate people to make sure that they are not reckless when they go backcountry, Brian Moore?
I think it's a community effort. I think it's the sport continues to evolve. It has since its earliest days in Vermont. And more of us are skiing in different ways. And as we can share those experiences with our friends and in our communities, all of us are going to be more capable as riders and skiers.
And then we had this from Jeremy, who's up in the kingdom in the Burke Kirby Victory area. He wants to know, will the Alliance be providing a template created by your group and Rasta that other areas could use to start up?
definitely. That is in the works with the backcountry terrain handbook. And we also have Rasta's ongoing projects right now. So they are actively engaged with the National Forest Service in the very earliest stages of planning for backcountry zones down there in the Rochester region. And right now, if you go to the National Forest website for the Rochester, Vermont area, they are accepting comments for the proposal that Rasta has put forth for that region. We also have a project in Braintree, Vermont that we started trimming and developing and are going to be managing moving forward responsibly. And those are going to serve as really excellent models to apply to other projects in other communities. So taking steps, you know, bit by bit, looking at how we are approaching this terrain, how the terrain is affected by increased use, and how the forest and the understory and the habitat is responding to this different kind of use. That's all going to be monitored, and we'll be applying the examples from the past to projects moving forward.
Michael Snyder, how much really skiable backcountry terrain is there in the state right now?
I would say, given the full spectrum of opportunities, it's hundreds of thousands of acres, literally. Because there's we tend to think of this backcountry as the most severe, challenging amount, mountain and alpine terrain, and that's certainly a big part of it. But there's also fantastic skiing in kind of the foothills as well, and even in the valleys. And so, there's 4.5 million acres of forest land in Vermont, and much of that is skiable.
And I hate to keep bringing up areas of contention, but there is kind of a rub between people who use these areas for recreation and the landowners themselves. So, again, what should the skiers and riders know about using someone's property? Brian Moore.
I think we are so lucky in Vermont to have such a generous community of landowners. And across the board, relationships between landowners and users in Vermont are really healthy. And that's really exciting. And skiing only stands to take that success and that sense of community we have to another level by engaging people in the landscape, by engaging landowners in the broader community opportunities that skiing present. A great example down in Rasta country in the Rochester area recently, Paul Kendall, an active Catamount Trail Association supporter and member, was actively involved in creating a new backcountry skiing zone near Braintree Mountain. And that step that he took in terms of stewardship and in terms of creating opportunities for skiers is a great example of how a landowner is giving back to the community and making land in Vermont available. Now, we as a ski community and as skiers and riders need to step up and appreciate that and show respect to that land and actively manage that land responsibly moving forward.
And we have this question from Mark about lost skiers. He says, is there any chance that a backcountry rescue policy will include a provision that those in need of rescue will be billed for the cost of the operation if they get lost or in over their heads? Either of you?
Well, I think that's ongoing. There have been a number of proposals for how to pay for this and how to build a system. There's some models elsewhere out west. I think that's in development, and I think, again, that's an area that we're working hard on. And I think we see a solution there that will both be reasonable in terms of recovering costs, but also minimizing the amount of rescues that have to happen.
The Vermont Backcountry Alliance did have a forum in November, and Tyler Cohen, who is editor of Backcountry Magazine, wrote to us and said, with a few others from the magazine, I attended the Vermont Backcountry Forum in November and was blown away by the attendance and energy. What the Rochester Area Sports Trails Alliance has done thus far to promote the sport in their region and bring together the community is quite impressive and can be a model for the state and much of New England now. now. A lot of this hour I've talked about contentious, you know, areas of this sport, backcountry, but you two both love it. So I'm going to ask you, make your pitch in about 20 or 30 seconds. Michael Snyder, you first. Why do you prefer backcountry skiing?
Well, as Brian said, I also like to ride the lifts, but I would sum it up very succinctly by saying this. Skiing is believing, and it's a kind of a metaphor for many things in life. Get out there, be challenged, be open to new experiences, be invigorated. Good things happen when you get on skis or a snowboard and get into the backcountry.
Brian Moore?
Amen to that. you know, I went out skiing this morning. We had a few inches of dense snow, and I was able to get into the woods behind my house. And I just think skiing and riding have the ability to really save the world, so to speak. The opportunity for skiers and riders getting outside and working together toward common goals that we all share is unlimited with the with these activities. So,
Brian Moore is the volunteer coordinator of the Vermont Backcountry Alliance. Michael Snyder, Commissioner of Forest Parks and Recreation. I want to thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
And coming up, while some people get jazzed for what's going on here on Terra Firma, at least one Vermont physicist will be celebrating what's happening in space tomorrow. We'll hear about a spacecraft launch party. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. What are you going to be doing tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock? If you're a space buff, you might want to head over to St. Michael's College in Colchester to watch the launch of NASA's new spacecraft Orion. John O'Mara is an associate professor of physics at St. Michael's College. He's hosting a launch party and a viewing session tomorrow morning. John, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. Now, this launch tomorrow, just a test. It's going to be an unmanned spacecraft, and the whole thing will be over by 11:30. But the plan is to eventually send astronauts up into space using Orion. How is that different from the space shuttle, which was canceled in 2011?
Well, the primary purpose of Orion is, like you said, to carry crew. The purpose of the shuttle was in many ways dual purpose, to carry both crew and pieces of the space station, or crew and satellites and things like that. But Orion, as designed right now, is primarily a crew transport vehicle to do things like meet up with the space station, or to bring crew to, you know, future spacecraft to go to the moon, go to an asteroid, go to Mars eventually. This is all part of NASA's, you know, primary goal of getting astronauts out to Mars.
So what do they want to learn from this launch tomorrow?
Well, this is going to be the first time that the Orion capsule and all the associated pieces of kit are going to be put together and put on a rocket and launched. And there's many aspects of the craft that you have to test. You have to test the abort system that's on top of the capsule that's there if something goes wrong during launch. You have to test the heat shield. They're testing the heat shield by having Orion come back into the atmosphere at 20,000 miles per hour, and the heat shield's going to heat up to about 4,000 degrees. They have to test Orion's electronics inside, because the craft will actually go outside the Van Allen radiation belts, which sort of shield the Earth from a lot of the nasty stuff. And so when we pass through the belts, we're going to be exposed to all the nasty bits that space can throw at us, and they want to be able to test all those pieces. And so it's really an integrated test of all of the things which they've tested in some ways individually, but really never as a full package until now.
John, you use some of the data from the Hubble Space Telescope in your own research. Are you going to be using anything from Orion? Will that help you in any way?
Well, Orion, one of the things that Orion could do in many years from now is be a key part of building, you know, not the next successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, which is the James Webb Space Telescope, which is launching in a couple of years. But the next telescope after that, you know, people have already started to think about these things, and those are giant beasts. They're 16-meter mirrors across, and that's going to take people to build in low Earth orbit, and Orion would take those astronauts up.
Wow. You've watched the live stream of every spaceflight launch that you could over the years. So what's so important to you about that?
Well, for me, for this launch, it's going to be the first time in a long time that I've seen something fundamentally new In a launch. You know, I watched all of the shuttle launches, and I've been very excited to watch SpaceX develop as a company and some of the other companies like Orbital Systems. But this is the first time I personally will be seeing NASA doing something really new that they have, you know, a brand new craft being launched. I was too young to really remember the early days of testing the shuttle with Enterprise and whatnot. But so that's why it's personally exciting for me, is to see them really try out a fundamentally new piece of hardware and see where it goes.
But what's so important about watching launches? I mean, I watch them. I think, oh, yeah, that's cool. I walk away. Tomorrow you're going to be watching them from, what, about 6 in the morning till I think it comes back into orbit at 11:30, something like that. You know, why?
Oh, well, I mean, for me, the response to watching the candle get lit, as it were, when the rocket launches, that's I get an almost visceral response to that. I will be probably hooting and hollering and clapping and all that stuff when it goes. And this just harkens back to watching the shuttle launches as a kid and just wanting to be a part of that enterprise. And so every time I see it go, I get really excited. I get jazzed up. It's hard to explain why. I guess it's fun. It's fun.
Were you disappointed when NASA scuttled their space shuttle program?
Well, you know, of course, I think everybody, even the people at NASA, were disappointed when the shuttle ended. But we needed to focus on ways to get human beings out of low Earth orbit, and that just wasn't going to happen with the shuttle. The shuttle was not designed for that. And Orion is a piece that's needed to take people beyond low Earth orbit, to take people back to the moon, to take people to Mars eventually. And the funding climate, the budget climate, doesn't allow for both of those things to coexist. We don't have enough of a budget to have both a shuttle and Orion at the same time.
How important do you think it is to send astronauts into space to continue to inspire young kids to get into science? Does it have a correlation?
Oh, I think it's critically important. I mean, I went into science because back when I was a kid, I wanted to be an astronaut. And I think so many kids and adults and anybody who sees NASA and what NASA does and witnesses the human part of space flight and space exploration gets really excited about it. We do wonderful things with rovers and robots out in space, but there is something fundamental about exploring as human beings as well that just really is an important part of all this and I hope remains a part of our culture for hundreds if not thousands of years.
Now, I'm still pretty fascinated that tomorrow morning you're going to be up early. You're going to be having not only watching the launch, but you're going to be having this launch party, this viewing party. First of all, you know, while other people host Super Bowl parties, this is your thing. Why? Why a party to celebrate it?
Well, why not? I mean, you know, like I said, it's the first time they're trying this. So why not have a bunch of people get together and be excited about seeing something happen for the first time and just being a part of the excitement? I mean, I won't have the great nacho dip or anything like that, but you know, maybe some coffee and some awesome science.
What about Tang?
Well, it's
all right.
I might roll with just coffee.
And what will be going on? So you want to entice people to come out and get up that early. What will be going on during your party?
Well, the launch as currently scheduled is set for 7:05. I'm going to open up the room at 6 o'clock. NASA will actually start their live stream at 4:30, which I'm not going to have the room open for that. And they are going to have constant ongoing commentary up until launch. And then the early parts of the launch are the exciting bits for the first 10 or 15 minutes. And then there's going to be a pause in excitement. They'll probably replay the launch. And then there's going to be various aspects of the mission that will be exciting to watch and hopefully get live image from the spacecraft in orbit. And then the splashdown is at around somewhere between 11:30 and noon, depending on launch time. So, you know, we'll go back and forth between probably replaying parts of the launch and listening to the live commentary. I'll be answering any questions that anybody has. And the first few hundred people can have a papercraft model of the spacecraft. I've got those there, courtesy of NASA.
Excellent. I can hear the excitement in your voice. John O'Mara is an associate professor of physics at St. Michael's College in Colchester. He's hosting a launch party and viewing session tomorrow morning. John, thanks for letting us know about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for today. Tomorrow, we'll look back on the last 40 years of the Howard Center with the retiring director, Todd Sennibert. If you've needed mental health or addiction services or assistance with a disability, chances are you've come into contact with the Howard Center. We'll talk about the services they provide and the challenges they've faced. If you have comments or questions about the Howard Center, email vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen, and Jane Lindholm will be back tomorrow. I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening.